call it climate irony, because the negative economic effects of climate change will likely happen where people tend to deny climate change is even real. This week on Techonomics, host Jason Middleton speaks with a co-author of a definitive county-by-county study about the effects of climate change on the United States. That conversation starts now.
Hello and welcome back, and thanks for listening. When it comes to existential threats, climate change is usually at the top of most people's list. It is, after all, literally a global threat. But some parts of the world are going to be hit harder from the effects of a warming planet. That's according to extensive data and research from a raft of scientists, researchers, and professors. The group has distilled their research into an elegant, easy-to-understand equation as well. Here's the takeaway. Every 1 degree Celsius of temperature rise will cost the United States roughly 1.2% of gross domestic product. So for the United States, where politicians recently decided to pull out of the Paris Accord on climate, the effects will be most felt in what is perceived as the deepest pocket of climate denial, the southeastern United States.
When we add up all of these different sectors together, the southern parts of the United States, places perhaps with on average lower incomes, are going to be hit much harder by climate change.
Here's part one of my chat with one of the co-authors of the study about the economic effect on the United States from climate change.
I'm Amir Gina, and I'm an assistant professor of public policy at the University of Chicago.
Professor, thank you for your time this morning. A fascinating study from you and several of your co-authors. The study itself is called Estimating Economic Damage from Climate Change in the United States. That's the headline used in Science magazine. Let's talk about the Climate Impact Lab. That was the incubator for this study, correct?
Yes.
How did that come to be?
Well, in a way, it came the other way around. The study was almost the incubator for the Climate Impact Lab. About 4 years ago, a group of us moved to the Bay Area to start working on what would be the independent risk analysis underlying a project called Risky Business, which was funded by a number of wealthy individuals and politicians, so Michael Bloomberg and former Secretary of the Treasury Henry Paulson among them. And they wanted to say something about climate change as an economic issue, trying to think about what the impacts were for business, the impacts were for investments over a really long-term horizon, which hadn't been thought about before. And we were the analysis that laid the bedrock for that report. And in doing so, we, I think, innovated on some new methods and realized that there was legs to what we were doing, really. And we continue the work of using a very data-driven approach with a strong focus on having evidence-based policy and trying to understand what the impacts of climate change were.
Very cool. And I have to say there was one takeaway that was kind of astonishing, and that is that the United States will face a 1.2% drop in gross domestic product for every 1 degree Celsius increase in temperature. Now, that was very succinct. It's very elegant. Can you tell us a little bit more about how you got to such a formula?
I think the history of this goes much further back. There was a group of models called integrated assessment models at around the time that we started thinking about climate change policy and carbon taxes. And what they do is they model the entire global economy and think about what the relationship is between climate change and economic activity. And for this fundamental relationship, what economic damages are caused by climate change, there wasn't that much evidence at the time, so often they had to use their best judgment on this, try and piece together information from a few studies. And then those models got really locked in place. They were used for, in fact, the calculation of the social cost of carbon, which is just a measure of the damages from a ton of carbon emitted that was used for regulatory purposes within the U.S. But in the past 10 years or so, there was this explosion of research about how to identify these effects using data. So part of it was advances in computing, it was new techniques which helped us understand this. So what we wanted to do was try and combine the two. We wanted to inform this economic damage piece of information on the whole economy, but do so using these techniques that were developing in the past 10 years. So that's what we did. We looked at the best studies that had been published on different outcomes that are economically important. We looked at mortality and crime and agriculture and labor productivity, coastal property damages, energy demand. We obviously had to leave out some for which there wasn't sufficient evidence. So things about water supply or ecosystem services, we just weren't able to say anything about yet. And we incorporated all of these very data-driven studies on what those relationships would be and came up with a methodology for projecting that into the future under different climate emission scenarios. So looking at all of those, adding them together, we monetized the values of these things, added them all up, and we were able to say then four different scenarios of emissions into the future, and the number that you're saying that you quoted before was for a kind of business as usual emission scenario. We are able to look at what the relationship is between future climate change and the damages that we measure to the U.S. economy. And so that's how we came up with that number.
Okay.
Kind of standing on the shoulders of many giants here on both the climate science side and on this, the economics of climate change side, and really trying to create something new out of that, given the advances that we've seen in the past 5 or 10 years.
The New York Times did a really wonderful county by county map across the country showing the impact of or how the impact would hit the hardest from using data from your study. And there's a concentration of deep impact in the southeast and southern middle west of the country. What can we extrapolate from that? Or what was your takeaway when you saw this come together?
Well, we were kind of stunned is probably the right word to see such a stark pattern. So the data that you're referencing shows that when we add up all of these different sectors together, the southern parts of the United States, places perhaps with on average lower incomes, are going to be hit much harder by climate change. We expected to see some unequal distribution across space, but when we saw the results that were coming out to us as we were doing this analysis, the damage function that you mentioned before, this 1.2%, we thought was larger than we expected for the U.S., but to see that a lot of those damages were concentrated in certain areas was, again, surprising. So the world's wealthiest economy that should be the most adapted to climate change was still experiencing damages, and in a way which was unequal across places. I think the reason that we see that is because one of the insights of the past 10 years of work here and the work that we're doing is that nonlinearities play an important role. And what I mean by that is that there's almost threshold effects in how temperature or precipitation affects us and our well-being. So if we think about health, it's not the 70-degree Fahrenheit day which is hurting us. It's the 90-degree Fahrenheit day or the 100-degree Fahrenheit day. And the damages become apparent very quickly when the temperatures get that hot. And a lot of places in the southern United States are very close to those thresholds. So they're not going to get benefits from warming days and fewer cold winters. They're just going to see the damages from increasing exposure to those hot days.
I see. And you said something in that answer, too, that kind of reminds me of another finding, which was the widening gap of income inequality, or just income inequality growing, too. Can you help me understand that and how your data addresses that?
When we sat back a few years ago thinking about how we wanted to present this information, the idea of doing this at a very local scale was important to us. And that was something that we had believed in for a long time, something that the funders of this risky business project believed, trying to make climate change, this very abstract global thing, very local. And so we thought we need to do this on a county-by-county level in the United States. And so we were not really thinking of what would happen with inequality, more thinking about just what the map of damages would look like so that a local business could think, well, my investments are here. Should I invest in Miami, which looks like it will have a lot of coastal property damages, or should I invest in Houston or somewhere else? The inequality story was one then which just glared out at us from the data, particularly when you think of the average incomes of the states that were affected. Now, probably the interesting thing is thinking not necessarily how current income inequality is a function of what we've experienced in terms of harsh environments, but the fact that the inequality that we see existing at the moment only stands to be exacerbated by climate change. And I think that has an important implication. This is not just something abstract about somewhere in the world that little pieces of air are getting hotter. This is something which fundamentally talks about our fairness in society and about the kind of society we want to have. So I think that implication is there and an important one that comes out of this research.
We're speaking with University of Chicago economist Amir Jena and his study, along with others, that finds that climate change will damage the U.S. economy and increase inequality. Dr. Jena, I am not breaking any news by talking with you about this study. It's been out for quite a while. But what I would like to get from you is a little bit of perspective. Who has been talking with you about this study and the data here? And I'm hoping to hear some surprises.
Well, I hope I can give you some surprises.
What I mean is maybe a climate denier who decided to maybe change their minds a little bit.
Well, so that hasn't happened so much. The political atmosphere at the moment is one which isn't really as conducive towards thinking about climate change. What I was surprised at was just the amount of media attention that this paper got because people were responding to those data. As a scientist and researcher, it was very edifying for me to think we can plot this map based on good research, and people are responding to information and data in a way which I hope they would. And part of that was that I don't think in this rigorous economic way, at least, there had been any study which showed the inequality effects, which is something which is on our minds a lot recently. Mm-hmm. The surprises, I think, that have come out of it is that our collaboration, the Climate Impact Lab, we've actually begun talking with a lot of local politicians, state-level politicians, anybody below the federal level, really, individual cities, who are very interested in this information. So there was a bit of a media attention that raised awareness of what we were doing. But now people are saying, well, we need to know for our planning decisions in City X, in Miami, in Chicago, in other cities around the country, what's our infrastructure going to be faced with in the next 50 years? These are long-term decisions. What are we doing about our investment in our power infrastructure? Any decision we make on that today are things which are stuck with us for 50 years, and so we want to make sure that we do them correctly. It's been very encouraging to see that below the federal level, there's been a lot of policymakers who are saying, who are now thinking of the idea of how can we use this data? How can we use this to communicate to our constituents, but also to start thinking through some of the hard decisions we're going to have to make in a time of tightening budgets, et cetera, of where our investments should go. So it's been very encouraging from that point of view. This is something that, you know, people did update their information based on seeing the data that we'd produce. Mm-hmm. And also it seems to be meeting some need that wasn't necessarily there before to think about climate change at a very local scale.
You know, incontrovertible data used to win out when it comes to ignorance, but it's tough to overcome willful ignorance, at the federal level, at least, it sounds like. Okay, so let's talk about next steps for you and the Climate Impact Lab. Can you share with us anything that might be coming up soon?
What we're doing now, building on this current study, is trying to take the impacts that we're seeing, the impacts that we're analyzing, global. So we're trying to say not just, you know, what happens in the southern United States, but what happens in sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia and East Asia, in places with poorer economies but growing very quickly. And that presents some unique challenges. In the United States, we have this amazing data collection infrastructure here where we have the information when we want to understand, say, the effect of climate change on labor productivity. We don't have that for South Sudan or Central African Republic. So we have to come up with techniques to try and extrapolate to those areas to say, well, what might the effect be in these places which are probably much more vulnerable? And so we're doing that, thinking about the same kinds of outcomes as before, about health costs, about labor productivity. Some new ones which come in there are thinking about migration and the way that people moving around in response to climate change might either help or hinder economies. And then a big one which of course is not an issue in the U.S., but thinking about civil conflict or large-scale kind of social upheaval, for which there's a pretty robust relationship with weather fluctuations. So thinking about those becoming more extreme in the future and what that might mean for human welfare and security.
This data and the research and the study is very accessible. It's easy for people to come in and, you know, be able to. This is real world stuff. It's not, what I'm trying to say is you can read it. Anybody who's listening can read it and get through it without having to go through all the endnotes. Are you a professor in the classroom as well or just research right now?
So in the classroom as well, yes.
So what are you seeing in the classroom? What kind of reaction? This existential threat is taken more seriously by people who are younger. Are you seeing that too?
I think so. When I mention this research to any of the students I'm teaching, whether it's in a specific class about the environment or even just about statistics, they're getting very excited about this issue. It's a pretty exciting time from a research point of view. At the same time, we're facing difficulties in this country with federal research funding, particularly towards earth sciences and climate change. So I'm from Ireland and I moved here 10 years ago because the U.S. has inarguably the greatest system of graduate education in the world. And I started working in my training on lots of National Science Foundation projects that professors had. And that's where I learned about how to do research. As we start to see those things drying up a little bit, so even though there's the excitement there among younger people to think about these issues, if the opportunities aren't there to learn the craft of them, then we're facing a potential generational gap. So there's a time of great optimism for learning about this, but also a time of concern as we start thinking about, well, where is the shortfall in the training on, in kind of cultivating minds to think about these issues? How is that going to be met? Mm-hmm. And what effect will that have 10, 20 years down the line when the next person comes either from the U.S. or from somewhere else to this country to try and learn about and to communicate that information back to society, where are their opportunities going to be to learn, or will they start to dry up?
Well, Dr. Jinnah, thank you so much for your time today. Thank you for all the work that you're doing. I've set a Google alert for your name, so anytime you guys publish again, I'm going to get it quicker this time.
Brilliant. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Have a good day, sir. That was University of Chicago economist Amir Jinnah about the benchmark research study that dropped in 2017. It's titled Estimating Economic Damage from Climate Change in the United States. Now, the study was first published in June of 2017. So we wanted to check in with Professor Jinnah to see if the study had gotten any traction. And it has, with the Climate Impact Lab now expanding its scope to global economic impact research. For links to the study, and you really should see the literal heat map of the counties that will be hit hardest, go to KGORadio.com and look for the story that goes with this week's show. If you'd like the contiguous interview in a podcast form, just search Techonomics on iTunes, Audio Boom, or Stitcher, pretty much everywhere else. Coming up after the break, we peer into the workplace abyss that is the performance review. You know them, you hate them. Thing is, so does your boss. We have a UCLA professor and his dedication to ridding the world of those annual job reviews.
Everybody's supposed to be able to improve to match any metric that a manager puts out for an employee. They're talking about human beings that are different than they're talking about avatars who can do things. People are imperfect.
I'm Jason Middleton, and this is Techonomics. Please come on back.